Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Methamphetamine addiction, recovery, once thought hopeless, still is very rare. A high percentage of folks who are addicted to the drug relapse. And the case we're going to talk about today, Karen Klum, was on meth for 6 months and spent 19 months in rehab. Her story, which starts at the age of 14, although the meth addiction doesn't start till she was 16, it's a success story. But there's been a price she has paid, and she and her father have shared that story in a memoir and a new animated documentary, Saving Karen. It was filmed in part at Circleville High School. The film will air Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Gateway Theater. More on that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. In the meantime, I want to welcome our guest to the show to talk about the film and to talk about meth addiction and its link also to sexual exploitation, local filmmaker and co-director of the film, Deborah Gregory. Deb, thanks for being here.
Hi, thanks, Ann.
Also, Karen Klum, co-authored Loss of Innocence, A Family's Journey with Meth with her father, Ron Klum. Karen, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, where are you calling from?
I'm calling from Montana.
Montana, okay. Well,
sleepy little Livingston.
All the way from Montana, we appreciate you joining the show. And then with us in the studio and joining us a little later, founder and executive director of Grace Haven, which will be opening a home for young women who are addicted to drugs and also dealing with the issue of sexual exploitation at the end of the year, Dr. Jeffrey Barrows.
And it's good to be here.
Appreciate it. And joining us in a little while, Amethyst Inc. CEO Virginia O'Keefe. Amethyst is a Central Ohio long-term gender-based addiction and trauma treatment program for homeless women and their families. She'll be joining us about half past. Karen, you're a rare example of a recovered methamphetamine addict.
Yes, I guess. So the statistics say.
Yeah. The addiction started when you were about 16, just to correct that note I made at the top of the hour, but the roots of the problem were planted when you were 14.
Yeah.
Can you tell us how that happened from your point of view?
I'd gone to a private school my whole life, and when I transferred into Whitefish High School, which was public, I didn't have any friends, and was a little overwhelmed, and so I made some pretty dangerous choices. I'd met a gal who seemed nice. You know, she seemed like the everyday person, everyday student. She had good grades, all sorts of different stuff, I mean, according to her, and she befriended me, and one day she was like, hey, do you want to skip school? We could skip the second half, and I was like, sure, and then she was like, we'd go to a football game, and I was like, I've never done that. That sounds exciting. I was like, well, where are we going to go? And she said she had a friend who was 21, and he'd buy us drinks, and we could just hang out and then go to the football game. We went over to her friend's house, and when he got there, he'd bought a couple of drinks. And as it turns out, there was something slipped into my drink called Rohypnol. It's also called Roofies. It's a date rape drug.
Mm-hmm.
And I was raped at 14. So it was on top of all the, I guess, other teenage hormonal, you know, madness. I didn't really know how to deal with that event on top of it. So,
if you're just joining us, my guest right now is Karen Klum. She's co-author of a book about a memoir of her experience surviving methamphetamine addiction. She wrote it with her father, Ron Klum. Karen's calling from Montana, where she grew up since, you were a freshman in high school then?
Yeah.
When you moved there?
Well, we moved there when we were really little.
Okay.
We grew up in Montana because my parents thought it was a safe place. They thought that, you know, there wouldn't be drugs. There wouldn't be, you know, there wouldn't be all the stuff that there was in L.A. And so we were raised in Montana, you know, and it just...
Well, it turned out to be sort of the meth capital of the world or something like that. Isn't Montana one of the worst?
We're working on our numbers. We're progressively making them much less.
We want to hear a clip from the film.
Fight.
After you were raped, you did try to tell your father that day or that evening when he picked you up and saw you struggling to walk, but he didn't want to listen. And that whole exchange, that whole dialogue with you and your father is pretty familiar. I mean, you know, wild children around the world have probably heard it a million times. You know what I mean, Karen? But he didn't want to listen. You wanted to tell him right away what had happened to you, and he didn't want to listen. So let's hear a clip from how you felt after that moment that moment of rejection.
I just emotionally shut down, and I just decided I wasn't going to talk to people anymore, and I don't know, I was going to numb myself as much as I could. Life went from being bad to horrible. Desperation overtook. I was in bad situations, and a lot of times I got out by the skin of my teeth.
In the film, Kieran, your dad says that he realized the very next morning that something horrible had happened. Why was that too late for you? What happened there?
I think that, you know, when you're, I mean, part of it was there were still some chemicals, I think, in my system that just had me, I don't know, had me open enough to try to say that something really, really bad happened. The next morning, I think I, you know, after you're trying to deal with it and, you know, you're trying to come to grasps with everything, then it just, I don't know, I just decided that it would be easier to pretend it didn't happen than to try and talk about it and then to deal with it.
Now, you and I talked earlier off the air, and this wasn't like a straight line to meth addiction. There were some corners. Your parents thought that maybe you kind of got your act together at a certain point after you went to a boarding school. What happened there?
Well, I mean, after I was raped, I started with marijuana and alcohol really heavily. And then my junior year, I transferred to a boarding school and was expelled because I had attempted suicide because of depression. And was sent home. And I did. And I did really well after that. You know, we kind of felt like, I don't know, even for myself, like I almost felt like maybe, you know, maybe things were going to be all right. Like maybe I was actually going to have, I don't know, have a life that, I don't know, was normal. And I don't know, I switched jobs because I'd been working something seasonal. And the people that I was working with were just, I mean, they were, again, everyday people, but we started partying, and it just one route led to another. And the right person was there. I mean, the person who had something to offer, I guess, when I was at a point again of wanting something else.
What did you want?
I didn't know. I mean, mm-hmm. I felt like, you know, I think I felt the typical low self-esteem that a lot of women feel in our society today. I felt overweight. I wasn't, but I felt like I was overweight. I didn't have the energy that was expected. I mean, I've been partying a lot, and so I was extremely drained from that, and then trying to keep up with work and, you know, all of the social life stuff. And so I just wanted a pick-me-up. You know, I tried diet pills. I tried a lot of different things for energy, and nothing ever really worked. And so I just asked, like, I asked a friend if they knew where I could get a boost, and that's all I said. You know, I mean, I'd heard about speed, and, you know, I mean, I guess in my mind, like, speed was just some energy capsule, you know, like a super-powered Dexatrim. You know, it was going to make me skinny fast, and it was, you know, going to give me energy. So a lot of that's, you know, my naivety. But, I mean, ultimately, somebody was there with methamphetamines. I had no idea what I was using, and it didn't matter, because after the first time I used, that was it. It was the top of the line.
The evening that you were introduced to meth, you didn't really know exactly what you were taking.
I had no idea.
And you know, it's interesting. You use the word a couple times in the film, and it's a word that I would use too, and that's sketchy.
Yeah.
The folks that you were with were sketchy.
Yeah.
Tell me about that a little bit, because you were very young, and they were very old-looking at the very least.
Well, they were – I mean, the gentleman who I'd asked, I mean, he was a clean cut. I mean, he looked like a very handsome young Adam Sandler. That's the only way I can describe him. But, I mean, a very clean
cut. Okay, that's a good description.
I mean, he was beautiful. Like, he was a very good-looking young man. And even a couple of the other people that I were with, you know, they weren't, I mean, they were, you know, they were thin and, you know, not the most glamorous. But, you know, there was an element of, you know, I don't know, where hairs on the back of your neck are kind of standing up, that maybe this isn't a good situation. But I don't know, maybe it was the alcohol or just the fact that I just had resigned myself that, you know, nothing mattered at the time. So, I don't know, I just went ahead and used.
We're going to hear another cut from the film. It's in this scene, you're describing what it was like to take meth for the first time that night. And you said that once you were high, it was like nothing else mattered. Let's hear that now.
Things all of a sudden became 100 times more heightened. I had tons of energy. Like, your heart feels like it's just kind of gonna jump out of your chest. I just never felt like I was anything extraordinary. And all of a sudden, I was unstoppable. I was amazing, and I didn't care if anybody saw it because I knew I was.
You know, we cut some of that out of there, but was the feeling that the attraction or the addiction, did you feel in retrospect, was it almost immediate?
It was definitely within, we were smoking it the first time I used, and it was definitely within the first two hits. I mean, I was just, I don't know, like all of a sudden, all the insecurities, it was like everything just melted away. And it was immediate. I mean, it was, you know, I didn't know exactly what was going on, but all of a sudden I just felt good. And it was something I wasn't used to feeling.
You know, one thing that struck me is you shelled out $600 that night, which was kind of shocking to me, that you did that. Did it occur to you that it was something more than just, you know, that it was expensive?
Well, I mean, I think that, I don't know, you know, we were partying. I mean, we were young people that were looking for a good time, and I'd been paid, and, I mean, I knew that there was another paycheck in the future, and, you know, I mean, I guess I had that personality type, too, where it was like, I mean, all in or nothing, and I don't know, you know, it seemed like $600, you know, it kind of, I mean, it sounded like it was going to be fun. I mean, and there had been some alcohol use prior to that.
Yeah,
to,
sure,
you know,
yeah.
Probably dilute the financial number, but, I mean, yeah, I mean, it was money that I'd worked hard to earn, but, you know, maybe I was just desperate enough at that time that it didn't matter.
You know, when you talked about having the hair stand up in the back of your neck and that you just went forward anyways, it made me feel sort of, well, sad, that it felt like you didn't feel like you deserved to be safe.
I think that, you know, there was a lot that helped to build that foundation for myself, and I think that's very correct. I didn't place a lot of value with myself that, one, I deserved to be with people who were much more safe than the people I was with, but I didn't have the value for myself that, I don't know, that I had more of a future than to be at that place in time and to be in that position.
And by the next morning, you wanted more.
Oh, I couldn't stop thinking about how to get more. I was in Bible study, and because that was my family's rule, is you had to go to church. And I was sitting there, and that clock just couldn't have gone any slower. And I thought of a million excuses until I finally came up with one to tell my parents why I wouldn't have to meet them at home. You know, and I just did. I left church. I left church to go and get more.
I thought it was interesting in the film that you said that Bible study had never been better.
I mean, it was, you know, we're sitting there talking about stuff, and, you know, I mean, it was just, I mean, I was, because I think the way the chemicals affect your body, you know, everything is just so much more heightened, you know, and so we're sitting there, and it was like, I don't know, I mean, it was Bible study, and people were talking, and it was like, I had an answer for everything, and I mean, I think I thought it had never been better, probably because I didn't stop talking. But, you know.
The folks who were with you might not have agreed.
I think the people who are with me are probably going, whoa.
Right.
Somebody have a seriously spiritual experience, or what's going on? You know, people didn't. My youth pastor did recognize that there was some funny behaviors for me, I think, fairly quickly. And he was always one who was really quick to openly confront it. Which is maybe why I did keep in contact with him.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect to all of this. I want to get back to that when we return to take a short break. We're speaking with right now Karen Clem. She is a co-author of a memoir about her experiences as a young methamphetamine addict, and also is in a new animated documentary, Saving Karen. It's filmed in part at Circleville High School. We have the director here. We have some other folks who know a lot about addiction issues, and we'll return with that and your questions and comments at 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Get the stories behind the headlines every day on All Things Considered. I think we're really benefiting from that staycation mentality.
At the Columbus Zoo, ranked number one in the nation by one travel guide, attendance is up about 30% so far this year.
Normally in a downturn economy, zoos and local attractions like zoos do very well.
On your drive home, listen to award-winning coverage from the WOSU news team on WOSU 89.7 FM.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. 52 degrees in downtown Columbus at 1021. Clouds today and a high of 63. A few clouds tonight and a low right around 40 degrees. Sunshine tomorrow and a high of 68.
Support for WOSU comes from the Sherrington Group Financial Planners and Investment Consultants, providing timely guidance, education, and options to complex issues affecting clients' futures.
All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about methamphetamine addiction and recovery. It is not hopeless, but it is very rare. High percentage relapse. Karen, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the film, but first I wanted to turn to the director, Deb Gregory. She's a local filmmaker in Columbus. Deb, welcome again to the show.
Hi, thanks, Anne.
How did you get connected to the story of Karen Clem way out in Montana?
Yeah, it's an interesting story. It's not something I chase after. It's I was actually approached by a local businessman here in Columbus, and he had read the book and was very interested in getting the story out to high school students. So he asked me if I would be interested in turning their story into a film.
So there's an organization that's involved in all of this? Or that Karen, isn't there an organization you work with to address high school students?
There is. There was a group called Teens in Crisis that was started in 2001. And then through that group, we started a program called Kids Talking to Kids, which is, it's enabled us to travel around the country and speak with students 5th through 12th grade.
Now, back when you first were introduced to the drug, it was a pretty isolated situation. It hadn't spread across the country like it has now.
I think it was something that, you know, it had definitely, we did not know near as much as we know right now. I mean, it was kind of like that speed kills, quote that and stereotype, but there was just, that's what it was left at. You know, it wasn't the understood methamphetamines, you know, the not even once, the, you know, the chemical breakdown and the complexity that it has become today.
Deb Gregory, who's your audience for this? How did you decide to package it?
Well, our audience primarily was high school kids. That's our vision was to put this in a format where it could be used in schools as a prevention tool. But since we've been screening it, it's amazing who our audience is. It's parents. It's people who work in addiction. People who work in the sex trafficking. So it's been very much more broad than I anticipated.
Why animation? I say it's an animated film. It's combination of animated and regular.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not really much out there like it, so I don't really know what to call it. We call it partly animated.
Okay.
I think Heather Arment, who is the co-director and she is the animator and illustrator, she and I just wrestled with the amount of dissonance in the story. We had Karen's perspective and we had her father's perspective, and there was conflict even within the story, and we didn't want to really resolve that. So we felt like we could create a third space, kind of stark and broken, much like their story, and just invite the audience to maybe put their own stories into the mix. And it was very experimental, but I think it's been very powerful.
Karen, what did you think when someone suggested making a film about this, a film documentary?
When the idea was presented, it was kind of refreshing because, I mean, we've been doing talks for a long time and I have my own family now and, we all kind of had toyed with this. And as Deb said, you know, we want this to be a tool that's in schools and to spread this message out much further than I can do on an individual basis. So So, and then the way when they brought in the animation and starting to see it, it was, I mean, it is, it's very, I think it's very well put together. So it's hard for me to watch, but at the same time, I think that, you know, it's definitely a powerful, I think it's going to be a powerful tool, and, you know, I have a lot of faith in it.
Deb, the visual depiction of addiction was really very haunting, and it seemed to me it was all about or mostly about the eyes. That seemed to be a big focal point. How did you decide how to do the animation?
A lot of that was just the brilliance of Heather Arment, who I don't know how she does it, but she was really able to pull out certain characteristics about Karen. And it's funny, I was just with Karen a few weeks ago at a film festival and hadn't really been face-to-face with her much. I'd seen more of her animation. And there were a few moments where I looked at Karen and I just saw the animation and was really impressed with these kinds of things that Heather brought out. But I think the eyes really show a lot of despair and maybe some of the emotional underpinnings of what was happening in the story, a lot of emptiness. And, so I think that's why we kind of focused on that.
And the eyes for the rapist were not unlike, but they weren't completely hollowed out like they were for the addicts either. There was more that aggressor in there. And it was interesting because they were pretty much the same eyes, didn't you think, Karen, at the beginning as when the violence was occurring? And but they were cast in such a different light.
I agree.
It was an amazing.
And speaking of eyes, I think what's been kind of haunting for me as a filmmaker is if you watch the film, if you see Karen talk about like her childhood and you look at her eyes, there's a certain quality to it. But when she switches over and talks about meth, there is a completely different quality behind her eyes. And I think that kind of shows what's happening in the brain and, you know, the emotional connections that are at play. So I think the eyes really do tell a lot.
At one point in the film, Karen, you described that night that you became addicted. You described one of the people that night as resembling Gollum from the Lord of the Rings. And I'm a big Lord of the Rings fan, so that resonated with me very quickly. And he's sort of like the Hobbit gone bad, who becomes addicted to the power of the One Ring that ruled them all. And I wrote all that off just off the top of my head. I can remember that. How did you – I mean, if I saw Gollum, if I was sitting around a campfire smoking anything with Gollum, I might be worried.
Well, I mean, it's funny you should – I don't know, bring that point up because, I mean, when Lord of the Rings first came out, I was on my first home pass with my parents, and we went to the theater because we had a short period of time to go and do something together, and they'd heard about this movie, and we went in to go and watch this movie, and Gollum showed up, and I was like, we have to leave the theater, and we had to leave the theater because it was just such an intense experience that I couldn't finish watching the movie. It took me years to watch Lord of the Rings. Because it was like going back in time. And I mean, you look at that and you look at that little man and you think about, you know, who would in their right mind, you know, and trust themselves to what somebody just of that presence would say. But I mean, my friend was like, he just has some issues. You know, he looks kind of scary, but he's a really nice guy. He just has issues. And my good looking young Adam Sandler friend told me that, and I believed him. So
that's interesting. If you're just joining us, we're talking about methamphetamine addiction with Karen Clem, co-author of a memoir about that experience and also the subject of a new documentary. It's called Saving Karen, filmed in part at Circleville High School. We have the director here with us, Deborah Gregory, and some other folks will be joining us in a few minutes to talk about the addiction process and the recovery process as well. We're going to hear again from the film right now. This is Karen after you disappeared. Your dad, you know, he's a former cop. He figured it out pretty quickly that you were on drugs. He could see your eyes were dilated, the classic. He could smell the chemical on your breath, which is something I can't relate to, but I guess it's sort of like smelling any kind of drug. And they gave you an ultimatum, and you took him up on it, and you left. He said you left with the clothes on your back. Yeah. Anyways, you disappeared for several months. You became, you know, got heavily involved in the addiction process, and your parent, but your parents were always preparing for your return and how to help you recover, which your mom started the book, Saving Karen, started a scrapbook, and that your dad at the time would stake out the site of a meth dealer he thought you were seeing and waiting for you, hopefully, to save you. And one night you showed up, and that's what we're going to listen to right now.
A car came up, and the door opens. And a tall, thin girl stepped out. You could see life was having its toll on her, and it was Karen. He just really started planning for Karen's death at that point. No way of getting her back. And never expected to see her again.
Okay, Karen, you were 16 at that time, right?
I just turned 17.
Just turned 17. You know, when you listen to your dad describe those things, does it seem like it's another world?
Yeah, it does.
Do you remember that night?
I do. You know, it's one of those things that, you know, and Deb was saying is, you know, that night my dad had a heart attack because, you know, he thought that I was going in to go and see this guy that we call Red in our book. His interpretation was that I was treating myself for the drugs, which I had been for a long period of time. But this man that, you know, he described was probably one of the, he was far surpassing Gollum and was really a scary person. But in his interpretation, that's, I was going in to trade myself, and he had a heart attack and wound up in the hospital shortly after that. I think that that's with Deb when she talks about, you know, sharing that space and then in the two people's interpretation, that's one of the reason that in our book we came from both sides. And with working with Deb, you know, and in conversations, you know, we feel it's so important to share both sides, the parent's interpretation and the child's interpretation, because in our lives, that's what it is. You know, the child's interpretation is so much different than the parent's. And there's a lot of times not that ground of communication. And so it leaves for, you know, it leaves for such hurt and pain. And I think that, you know, it was definitely something that was probably beneficial in our case, because that was kind of the turning point for us.
Yeah. Well, how did you, well, I guess I'm jumping ahead, because before all of this happened, you came back, you did see your father in the hospital one night, but you wouldn't hug him.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that?
I felt like he was in the position he was because of myself. You know, I mean, I knew that he'd had heart problems, and I didn't know he had been following me. I had no idea. But when I saw him, I felt I could never come back, ever. I felt like, how could anybody who was living the life of a prostitute and a drug addict go back to their family? And so I just decided that there was no future, and there was no out, and that it would be better to die than to even cause more pain by false hope.
But you did go back.
Yep.
How did that happen?
I attempted suicide shortly after seeing my dad and woke up very, very, very sick. And my good friends, I like to, you know, just make note of that, because I just thought that I always had these good friends, you know, that these people would be there to back me and, you know, and you know, they were my friends. And my good friends, you know, were like, you've been really sick, but we didn't want to take you to the hospital because we were afraid we'd get arrested. And I was like, I just need to get to my youth pastor's office. And I called my parents and had him call for help for me.
I was interested that you stayed connected with your youth pastor. I think that's, I don't know, maybe was your lifeline.
It was really interesting because people always ask, you know, why did you stay connected with him? And he wasn't, I don't know, he wasn't somebody who was, you know, always telling me that, you know, I don't know, he wasn't your typical youth pastor. I mean, he wasn't telling me, you know, I don't know, come to the light and all this kind of stuff. I mean, he told me, he was like, you know, he's like, your life doesn't have to be this way. And he would confront me. He would be like, how do you feel? Where did you wake up this morning? How does it make you feel about yourself? And, you know, are you tired yet? You know, you can always come home. And it was like, I mean, he would tell me about my parents. He would relay cards, you know, and he would encourage my parents to keep, you know, giving cards. And I don't know. I mean, it was one of those things. I don't I don't know why I stayed in contact with him, but he was a person I went to, and I was like, I think I need some help. I tried to kill myself and came pretty close, and I told him I was scared. And he was somebody, too, you know, talk about having a network, you know, with people. That's part of the reason we started Teens in Crisis, because you have to have a network of people to go to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I went to him, and he automatically had my parents and the escorts and, you know, everybody within a day was ready to move me out of the area.
And where did they move you? They moved you to? Did you immediately go to Jamaica, or was there some?
I went to a 21-day program in Idaho.
Okay.
It was a detox program. It was one of those little wilderness survival ones that you had a lot of evaluation, and it was really beneficial for me. It gave me a lot of tools that I think I still use today. But that was 21 days there, and then I transferred to Jamaica.
Your folks pretty much sold everything.
Yep. We sold our house. They built this house, and it was designed so that they could live there into their ripe old age, and we sold that. We sold cars, and I had used a lot of funding, my sister's funding for her school, and then sold my car, and, I mean, everything that they could do to pay for it, they did.
I guess the point being there is not to, you know, belabor any kind of guilt. It's to say it's not cheap.
Oh, it wasn't. It was over $130,000 to send me to treatment.
And you went to
Jamaica. That was one of the cheapest ones. That's the reason they sent me to Jamaica, was because it was one of the cheapest ones, because insurance doesn't cover, it doesn't cover rehab.
Strangely. You were there for 19 months, and you were kind of toeing the line, and it was extremely structured. I was fascinated by that. Everything from how you walk down the hallway to, you know, how you ask for things. And then, you know, but you were toeing the line, and you were going to do your job there and get it over with and get out. But something happened that pushed you maybe farther and pushed you where you needed to go. And that was an interaction with another patient.
There was a young gal who came in, and same scenario. You know, she was 3 months from turning 18. I don't even think it was 3 months. I think it was like 3 weeks. I mean, she was so close to turning 18, and, you know, she was like, I'm just not supposed to be here. And, you know, we'd all told her, we were like, just do your time and then find out when you're 18. You know, it's a lot of rules and it's, you know, whatever, but, you know, you can do it for, you know, 3 weeks. I mean, come on. It's like, you know, not that big of a deal. And she committed suicide. And it was definitely an eye-opening experience for myself, because they say that, you know, when people relapse, they always go back 10 times harder than they did before. Because, you know, when you quit, you've got this idea of how much you're using, you know, and then when you go back, you start using what you were before. And that's where overdosing starts. And, you know, we started to learn all these things. And, you know, for me, in the back of my mind, I was like, I'm just going to go home and hang out with my friends. It's not going to be that big of a deal. You know, like, I mean, yeah, okay, so I've got an addict, so I just won't use as much. Or, you know, I justified all these things. And when this gal committed suicide, it was a real eye-opening experience that this was it. Like, this was my last chance.
We're going to have to take another break. Talking about methamphetamine addiction, when you just were hearing from Kieran Clem. She is the subject of a new documentary. It's called Saving Kieran. We'll be back to talk more about this in a few minutes. If you have a question or comment, don't hesitate. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu. And when we come back, we'll hear from the CEO of Amethyst Inc. and also Grace Haven founder Dr. Jeffrey Barrows, and maybe even hopefully the film director, Deborah Gregory, some more. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Thursday night at 8 p.m. on WOSU-TV. Tune in for WOSU's special culinary event, Chefs in the City. Now in its fourth year, this year's gourmet food experience features PBS celebrity master chef Rick Bayless and several other local chefs who share their cooking tips and tricks and prepare mouthwatering recipes. Be sure to watch Chefs in the City on WOSU-TV this Thursday night at 8.
And you're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will be here, and we'll hear about the Ohio State University Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, State of Black Ohio Report. That discussion begins at 11, right here on WOSU. And tomorrow night at 9 on WOSU-TV, POV presents Food, Inc., with a look at American agriculture business that produces more food on less land at a cheaper cost than the farmers of any other nation. Watch POV Wednesday night at 9 on WOSU-TV. 53 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:41. Clouds today and a high of 63. Clouds tonight and a low right around 40 degrees. Sunshine for Wednesday and a high near 70. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about methamphetamine addiction. It has swept the country. Back when Karen Clem first became addicted, it wasn't as well known. Now, I don't think I need to belabor the topic too much as far as how powerful this chemical is and how quickly people can become addicted to it. It's also a business. And Ron Clem, Karen's father, he's a retired Los Angeles police officer, in a bonus track from the DVD Saving Karen, he explains how the methamphetamine drug business operates in the United States. It's a highly efficient pyramid scheme, kind of, I guess we can call it a Madoff scheme in a way. Ron describes one drug dealer, Stephen. He's the man who raped and later provided drugs to Karen. And Stephen recruits 6 teenage boys to distribute methamphetamine at a local high school. This pattern of local drug dealers is replicated throughout the local area, he says. Here we go.
There's about 20 of these operational drug dealers throughout the Flathead Valley that comes in here, and all of them are using the same technique. They would use the girls for sex, that would draw in the boys. And once the boys are there, then they would use the boys as their theft rings and for distributing drugs and things like that. It's like these guys go to a drug school, and they learn to do the exact same thing.
Virginia O'Keefe from Amethyst, how much of this are you dealing with, this sort of the business part of it when you're taking people in?
I'm not sure what you mean by the business part.
Well, they're part of an organization. They're not necessarily just isolated. They have other people out there, like Karen was talking about earlier. Her good friends were mm-hmm. part of the problem.
Well, I think I'm struck by listening to the conversation about, you know, the path of addiction and the substance. It follows the same journey as we do. I'm in recovery myself, and I just, you know, heard about the shame and the guilt that keeps us from accessing treatment, and I heard about the physical and sexual abuse, which about 90% of the women we see have those issues also. So Columbus is not a really big center for meth addiction. It's more rural still, and we have not seen a massive impact on our client load. But it's a drug I know from serving on the Rebecca Project for Human Rights in Washington, D.C., where we have a national women's network of treatment. The Midwest and West, the absolute devastation, not only on the individual, but family members. I've seen whole family members who work in the labs, mm-hmm. Mother, father, brother, all go down the path. So it's a very devastating drug.
The issue of sexual exploitation, familiar?
Oh, absolutely. I said, you know, mm-hmm. whether it's trafficking or what our women are doing to obtain their drugs, they're the same clients in many, many cases. So that's a given.
Also with us is Dr. Jeffrey Barrows. He's the founder and executive director of Grace Haven. You're going to be opening up a home for tell us a little bit about that and how this applies.
Yeah, Grace Haven is an organization that is going to focus on the needs of girls under the age of 18 who have been victims of severe sex trafficking or, as it's also known, commercial sexual exploitation. Currently, there is no organization in Ohio that's focused on helping these girls, especially girls under age 18. So we're hoping to change that and be open in the fall.
And drugs are usually involved.
Yes, drugs are very much involved. And I'm also struck by listening to Karen's story because what we're seeing is an evolution. I mean, the focus in her story is the drug addiction. But what we're seeing now among traffickers is changing from primary business being drugs to the primary business being selling young women and using drugs to keep control of those young women, because you can only sell a drug one time. These criminals have found that you can sell a woman 10, 15, 20 times every night and make a lot more money.
Karen, how much when you go to talk to kids in high schools about this, what sort of feedback are you getting?
The feedback that we get from kids in schools when we go and talk, I'll just say we talk 5th through 12th, but when we talk to 9th through 12th graders, and this, I mean, it doesn't matter where you go. When you ask them how many of the kids know somebody within their age group, 9th through 12th, that's a year above or below, who knows somebody who's using an illicit drug, 80 to 90% of the kids will raise their hand. When you ask them how many of them know somebody whose parents are using drugs, again, you know, maybe 70 to 80% of those kids are going to raise their hand. And whether it's they all know the same parent, whether, you know, they all know the same kid, they all are knowing somebody. So that means it's available. And the kids talk about, you know, drugs in school, and that's for me the most heartbreaking thing, because they talk about it, and it's not just methamphetamines. I think that's a really, you know, neat point that was brought up, is that it's not just mm-hmm. methamphetamines. Wherever you are, you know, there's a path that starts this. You know, I have kids come up and young women come up and tell me every time we go and speak that they know somebody who is sexually abused. I had a young man come up and tell me that his girlfriend was gang raped and he doesn't know where she went. She just disappeared. You know, so, I mean, these kids have stories everywhere you go, and, you know, the drug use and sexual abuse and then the path going down and the spiral downward, you know, it's just so consistent.
I really appreciate what you're saying, because we see the same things here. You know, the woman who might have been sexually abused when she was young, never told anybody, and then begins to use the substance to self-medicate. So, you know, we see that that physical and sexual abuse is an entry. So,
and from what Dr. Osment was saying too, is, you know, when you have these young people that are going through the drug abuse, you know, and to keep these, and for what drug dealers are doing to keep people involved, you know, I mean, when you have somebody who is, you know, and we said it in the documentary, but when you have somebody who's hurting so badly through sex abuse or whatever, you know, that becomes their resource to not deal with their emotions, you know, as drugs are there.
Is it that, you know, I was talking about this with someone this morning, that I can hardly imagine somebody kicking a dog, let alone addicting somebody, getting somebody addicted to something like methamphetamine to use them. Was Steven, the drug dealer, the guy that raped you in the first place, do you think he was actually conscious of what he was doing?
I'm very sure he was.
Okay. I mean, that's how, you know, it's so impossible to understand. I guess that what keeps us from solving the problem.
Well, there was a young woman, to give you an idea, there was a young woman who, it's the same thing, it's consistent everywhere you go. And I think when you look at this large perspective of trafficking and whatnot, these are the people that are there around every school. Everywhere we've gone, this is consistent as well. There was a young woman who used to work out of a house that was right next to the high school in the Flathead. And, I mean, it has been everywhere we've gone, there is this similar situation. She worked out of the house next to the high school, and her job was to recruit young women. So she would befriend young women. She wasn't enrolled in the high school. She just was available. She was available. She was friends of friends, and she would recruit young women to come and become addicted. And she would give them their first use. You know, she would tell them, yeah, it's going to make you skinny. You're going to get great grades. Mm-hmm. And that's what she would do. And later on, after she was clean for a long time, she had gotten her kids back, and she became desperate for finances to keep her family and to go to school. And there was a man who said, look, he's like, you know, if you recruit young women again, he's like, I'll help you pay your bills. And he recruited young women into one of the largest drug and prostitution rings in the Flathead.
I guess, Virginia, you're familiar with that dichotomy, someone who wants to protect her children and put food on the table.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, we take women and children into the treatment program to eliminate that barrier so that they know that the children are going to get help too. Otherwise, they'll become tomorrow's clients. So working with the whole family, we really is what you need to do. And if we could bring this fact to the attention of legislators, that what we save our communities is millions of dollars if we provide the treatment that's necessary rather than sending them to jail, which costs about $30,000 per woman per year, or a child into foster care is about $28,000 per woman per year. And if you add it all up, I have a budget of about $3.5 million, and I can show that the services we provide save the community $3 million. So we have to begin to make an impact on the policy so that there is treatment available, which is not. The budgets are shrinking, the money is shrinking, and the problem is not going away.
No, I was going to ask Dr. Jeffrey Barrows, you're getting ready to open up Grace Haven as a home for girls under the age of 18, and you said there's nothing else like it. These are girls who have been exploited sexually. There's nothing else like it anywhere around here.
Not in the state of Ohio.
We're starting to change how we look at prostitution and, you know, how what the role of the prostitute is in this in the dynamic, more as a victim.
Exactly.
Well, it's also what women do to survive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is a way that women have taken care of themselves for years, unfortunately. And our program, as I said, we have women and women with children, and we think there's only about 70 what we would call family-based treatment centers in the entire country. And you know, as I said, prostitution goes part and part with it. It's an issue we need to bring to light, so I appreciate this time.
You know, the idea that Karen Clem spent 19 months in treatment for an addiction that lasted 6 months is kind of just shocking. But Virginia, your Amethyst, the typical stay is what, 23, 24 months?
Absolutely. And the research supports that 2 years would be ideal because, you know, the impact and the damage to the brain, to the health system, you know, 21 days, you know, I'm in recovery in 21 days. I didn't even have my head on straight.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just even the addiction. It's family of origin. It's lack of employment. It's the physical and sexual abuse. You have to deal with it all or they become the relapse factors.
Dr. Barrows, how do you even pull something like this together? Where do you start when you're starting a new program like this?
That's an excellent question because I do feel like I am inventing the wheel. There are currently only three organizations in the country that focus on these girls.
Specifically on girls?
On girls that are domestic minor sex trafficking victims. There's one in Los Angeles, one in Atlanta, and one in New York City. And those three are very different from each other. In fact, the one in Atlanta only keeps girls about 4 to 5 months. So as we've been looking as a group to starting Grace Haven, we really have taken the view that we are inventing the wheel, trying to put together a program that is all in-house where the girls can get and continue their education. They can get in-house counseling. They can be mentored. And they can also mentor each other in their various stages of recovery and rehabilitation.
Now, Virginia O'Keefe, CEO of Amethyst, I understand. Starting a new program always feels like you're inventing the wheel, but mm-hmm. you've been dealing with these dynamics for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Mentoring is a big part of your program.
Absolutely. We have what we call community of recovery, and we have the same kinds of principles. You look at cognitive-based therapy, you look at structure, you look at restoring self-esteem, you look at the trauma, and it's a very comprehensive program. The adolescents are difficult, and there's not much services for any adolescent who is an addict anywhere. But our women also have started using at such a young age. They're like adolescents. And we're very familiar with Grace Haven, admire what they're trying to do.
Yeah, I guess the difference is that they're shooting for the younger
Absolutely.
Group. You're trying
Absolutely.
To get younger and younger, acknowledging that this is starting younger
Absolutely.
And
Absolutely.
Younger.
And sometimes the younger they are, the harder the denial is to get past because they will think things like they're in control, you know, and I know what I'm doing when I prostitute. There's an emotional detachment
mm-hmm.
from the younger ones, become addicted to excitement, and, you know, so there is some difference by age groups.
I just have time for a couple more questions. And, Karen, one of them is to you. In the documentary, you're in the Circleville High School, I believe, that was all filmed there. And you're telling the auditorium filled with the high schoolers that when you started that program, the kids to kids, and started going to high schools and speaking to them, there was a larger group of you that went to these schools together. And you're up there alone on the stage. Can you tell us what happened to them?
Yeah, one of the women was actually the one I just referred to earlier. She relapsed and she lost her family, and I don't know where she is today. It was a desperation that started it, financial desperation to maintain sobriety and live this new lifestyle. And the other students, we used to work with a school called Spring Creek Academy, and the school closed down. It was a long-term treatment program for kids under the age of 18. We don't know what happened to those kids, but majority of the people, there were three people that would stand up next to us that we know relapsed. We know one has died that has, you know, somebody that had been traveling with us a long time, and one is going to school, you know, and fighting to stay clean and sober.
Okay, and then one more question for you, Deb Gregory. How age-appropriate is the film for younger children? How young would you go?
We're recommending ninth grade and up.
Okay.
The reality is that this kids that are younger than this are facing these troubles.
It's up to the parent, maybe.
So it's up to the parent, exactly.
Right. Okay, we're just about out of time. I want to take the time, though, to thank all my guests today. Deborah Gregory, filmmaker and co-director of Saving Karen. It will be airing Saturday at 7 p.m. at the Gateway Theater. More on that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Deb, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And also Jeffrey Barrows, he is founder and executive director of Grace Haven. He'll be opening up a program for a home-based program for 10 girls by the end of the year. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Ann.
And Virginia O'Keefe, CEO of Amethyst Inc. Virginia, thanks for popping in with us today.
Well, and thank you for bringing attention to a subject that gives people hope that recovery has the power to restore your life.
And finally, Karen Clem. The subject of our topic today, the star of the show. Karen, thanks for sharing everything with us today.
Thank you for having us.
Take care. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.